This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's start things off bringing in Mark Chase, who's one of the key editors for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Mark, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, Chris.
And I know you have been especially busy in the last few weeks doing a lot of number crunching, and it's all going to come about with the culmination of which is going to be a 20-page special section in this weekend's newspaper. Tell us first about the project and how much work you seem to have been involved in all these last few weeks.
Sure. Well, Chris, the deep dive comes on a series of or a type of story that everybody cares about. Anybody that's spent any time in the region knows of the congested roadways and traffic issues, and most of us have passed a nasty accident or two or maybe more in our time living here in Northwest Indiana. We wanted to do a deep dive into the roadway fatalities in Northwest Indiana, and we did so by obtaining data from the U.S. Department of Transportation. We had 5 years of data. Basically, what we were able to do is isolate 373 fatal crashes in Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties, and the specific data for each of those over the 5 years, 404 people died in those crashes. And so really this is sort of a potential for fatality that everybody faces every day when they get onto some of the region's most congested roadways. We spent several months sort of sifting through the data, looking for the common threads and causes of these crashes, and that's what this 20-page special section is going to do. It's going to lay out exactly where these are. It's going to quantify the problem in the various areas where it exists in its worst form in Northwest Indiana. It's going to be taking a look at the things that have caused these crashes and maybe even some of the political roadblocks that stand in the way of some of the solutions.
When you had to go through the data, you obviously went through every community here in the three counties. Did it seem to find that most of these fatal crashes happened on major highways, interstates, or major highways otherwise, like, for example, U.S. 30 or U.S. 41?
Yeah, it should be no secret to anybody that when looking at the top 10 stretches of roadway over the three counties, we're looking at I-80, 94, and 90. Sort of leading the pack up on that side of things. But then U.S. highways, if you take all of the U.S. highways together, there are more fatalities on those than there were on the interstate corridor. State roads, heavily traveled county roads, these are all places that are going to be showing up on our map.
Some of the information I'm sure that you had, not only, of course, you've gotten from Indiana State Police and from the sheriff's departments in the three counties, but what kind of efforts did the local community police departments help you with in tracking down the information that you all needed for this special section?
Sure. I mean, theirs is the anecdotal. Here's how we've responded. Here's some of the things we've seen. Here's what we've observed. Mm-hmm. They really helped kind of flesh out the information between the lines of data. In other words, every time a fatal crash occurs, they have to report this information to the USDOT, and it's a pretty detailed, long process that they take for each one that documents several different details. But even with the data and even with all the details that we were able to glean from it, there's only so much information we can get from that. The police officers who actually responded to these things can paint a much better picture.
So that's where the police departments really come in handy, I guess. And the state troopers and the county sheriff's deputies are out there doing getting the material together that they have to turn in for their reports, right?
Right. Yeah, and absolutely. And the data that we were working with is provided by the individual agencies.
One of the things that you note that's going into much more detail in the special section coming up this weekend talks about some of the causes for the problems that pop up on these deadly highways. And one thing in particular that you bring out, one common thread, I'm sure there's several, but one of the probably most common threads is roadway congestion. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that it gets pretty busy on highways in Northwest Indiana.
No, when you couple the... You know, we have one of the heavy, if not the heaviest, heavy truck traveled corridors in the nation here in Northwest Indiana, with semis coming through with freight. The 80-94 corridor, the I-65 corridor, these are some of the busiest stretches of roadway in the nation. And so when you get the kind of speed and congestion combined together and some reckless behavior that's woven in there, and some drunken driving that's woven in there.
Yeah.
It turns into quite a deadly cocktail around here.
Well, I would imagine the driving while intoxicated is one of the major problems. The local police, of course, run into that, but they're not dealing with accidents with high speed and alcohol or drugs involved.
Yeah, you know, and that this really is something that emerged as sort of a key finding here. Everybody knows about the problem of drunken driving, what it can do. Everybody has heard of, seen, or even known somebody or a family member that's died in one of these types of crashes. When you look at the raw numbers, though, it's really stark. In our region, about 35% of all fatal accidents had a drunken driving component to them that were caused by some form of intoxicated driving. And that's about 10 percentage points higher than the rest of the state and the nation. So we have it's a problem everywhere. It's an acute problem here.
We're talking with Mark Chase with the Times of Northwest Indiana about a 20-page special section coming out in the newspaper this weekend, which is entitled "The Region's Deadliest Roads." And you talk about all the number crunching and everything that you had to gather together from all of the area police departments, as well as the sheriff's departments and the state police. And you just mentioned here about the impact that these accidents have because of maybe, and you may know somebody that's been involved in an accident, unfortunately, that led to death. What kind of information, just a preview, I guess, in a way of what is going to come up that you gathered in the project about what family members who have lost loved ones because of traffic accidents, regardless of the circumstances behind them?
Yeah, so for every single pinpoint of a fatal crash that we have on a map, and there will be a very large map showing where every single one of these occurred, but for every single one of those dots, there's a human face. There's a life lost. Most of these lives that were lost were local people. Some of them were pass-throughs, but you know, when you're in the area of locality, most of the people that die are going to be people from this region who are dying in these crashes. And we were able to touch base with many of these folks, parents that lost a son to a drunken driving crash, and some of the struggles they had with even trying to forgive the individual that caused the crash.
Yeah.
We have a gentleman that we profile in the series or in the special section who was racing home on a report that somebody had been vandalizing or breaking into a home that he owned, and he ended up running over a young girl in the process.
Oh.
There's just some really heartstring type things that we have woven in here that I think really put the human drama into why this is important.
Now, in getting all of this information together, of course, you had all this data to sift through to be able to make sense of it all. How much work did you and others there on the staff of the Times have to put together in getting the graphics that will make it easy to understand?
Yeah, it was a lot of work. I mean, it's helpful when you have a big cache of raw data like this that you can pull into Microsoft Access database, and you can generate spreadsheets off of that. And of course, that helps with our graphic designers in putting numbers to color and to charts that actually put it into usable and understandable format. Quite a bit of work went into it, and you'll see that laced throughout the section.
Now,
you know, the double truck map, this big double spread of the map pinpointing all the accidents. We have a map of the entire state of Indiana breaking down county by county throughout the entire state where the fatal crashes have occurred over the last 5 years. And, it's going to be very colorful, but also hopefully something that they want to keep on their coffee table throughout the week and revisit.
Well, certainly. Yeah, but you'll have the chance to review all this information to be sure. How many other folks work with you on this project that'll be visible in the paper this weekend?
Yeah, so we had a team of, I believe we had four or five different reporters who were helping out over time. And not all of them had a lot of heavy lifting, but that many people contributed to the product in the end. We had a good graphic designer from our design staff. And, of course, there will be a lot of digital and online components to this, too, which will be different and, in some cases, more interactive than what you can put on paper.
Now, I guess let's follow up here on what we've talked about here with mentioning about the special section. When will folks get to see it in print and online?
This will be in Sunday's paper. So the special section will be in there. All of the content that we've put together will be in that special section. There will also be some digital components that will be sort of extras that people will find out about in the print edition. And then throughout next week, a lot of these stories will be showcased on our website, and at any time, all of them will be accessible through a collection that we're putting together on our website.
I was going to ask if you're going to be able to follow through in the days ahead, because you have this one day that the entire project will be out there to see and for people to pick up copies if they wish, and then what you have to have online as well, too. I'm sure is going to spread it out, and you mentioned that that's the project objective, to be sure. So, Mark, the best of luck to you, and congratulations for what we've learned so far. We're looking forward to seeing the special section in Sunday's Times, and to everybody that's helped out on this project, we can certainly say thanks, and it's a sobering at the very least, but a revealing topic to bring up these days, and since we deal with the traffic problems so much every day in Northwest Indiana, it's certainly a topic that's worth taking up here. Mark, thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Great, Chris. Thanks for having me.
High school students are earning money for getting good grades or visiting a college campus. The national organization Raise Me launched the idea of micro scholarships 5 years ago. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright tells us, with the increasing cost of higher education, Raise Me officials are touting micro scholarships, as they're called, as ways to help students pay for school.
Christopher Pack is an artist, and it shows when you step into his room. His wall is lined with a mix of black and white portraits and colorful action scenes.
You know, I started practicing and really started honing my skills with drawing.
One of his favorite things to bring to life on paper, superheroes.
This is Deadpool. Everyone should know him by now. You know, they made movies about him.
And if you don't know, he's a foul-mouthed anti-hero, a Marvel character. It makes sense that Pack plans to study visual and sports communications in college. He recently graduated as valedictorian from a small charter school in Indianapolis, and he says college wouldn't have been possible without micro scholarships.
With Raise Me, I was able to see all the achievements I went through, and I would say, you know what, let me just put them in and see what I get.
Pat created a profile on Raise Me and started following institutions that offer micro scholarships. From there, he added in his achievements from freshman to senior year and got an estimate from each school of how much money they would offer him. Students can receive money for good grades, volunteering, and participating in sports. They can range from, say, $75 to up to $6,000. More than 1 million high schoolers across the country are using the free platform. Raise Me Director of Partnerships Miles Hodge says that includes about 25,000 in Indiana.
It really is changing the dynamic, and it's having students start to think about it earlier and also exposing them to schools they might not have ever thought of before.
Pack committed to IUPUI. The school just partnered with Raise Me last year. Beth Knight is the director of IUPUI's scholarship office. She says the university liked the idea of offering the small scholarships.
You're basically encouraging the student to do things that they need to do to really become college prepared anyway, but you're giving them sort of an allowance in these micro scholarships along the way, and it makes them feel actively engaged.
Indiana State University started offering micro scholarships a couple years ago. Associate Vice President for Enrollment Management Richard Toomey says higher education institutions used to focus their recruitment efforts on juniors and seniors, but he says micro scholarships allow them to do meaningful outreach earlier.
If a student comes and takes a college tour and actually registered through our admissions office and experiences campus for a day with us, we will actually award them a one-time $500 scholarship to actually enroll at Indiana State.
Although funds received through micro scholarships won't necessarily pay for a student's entire tuition, experts say it can be a good recruitment strategy. But Lumina Foundation Strategy Director Haley Glover says universities can't stop there.
Being able to support students once they get to college is equally, if not more important than getting students to the door of the college.
Since the platform is so new, there's not much data to measure its impact. But Hodge says some schools are seeing higher GPAs and more students staying enrolled on average. And maybe most importantly, it encourages high schoolers to start thinking about their finances earlier.
The value of education has never really been focused on more than it is now. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about student debt. And so really finding the types of aid that can help students pay for college and college affordability is really important.
That's why it was so important for Pack to find multiple ways to pay for school. He knew his parents couldn't, so after receiving more than $7,000 in micro scholarships, he applied for more scholarships.
And I just found what's out there, and Raise Me just kind of was that push to say, hey, there's more out there. You just got to look for them and just apply.
Pac started at IUPUI this semester, and his tuition costs are completely covered. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
Now, some high school career and college advisors say that micro-scholarships aren't a priority for their low-income students. That's because the higher dollar aid often trumps any micro-scholarships. But they say that micro-scholarships can fill gaps for other students. It's Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and on this Thursday, we're turning now to one of our favorite business writers here in Northwest Indiana. Joe Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana is checking in from the newsroom over in Munster, and as always, Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We have quite a bit of stuff here to talk about, and a lot of it, I know, is related to the United Steelworkers Union, to U.S. Steel, and no doubt other players in the steelmaking industry here in the region and around the country, too. Bring us up to date on the situation right now as it stands, and we do what you have described, or at least as mentioned, as maybe it could be one of the largest work stoppages probably since the 1980s. It is potentially happening.
Yes, there is definitely the potential of the largest strike since 1986 in the domestic steel industry. Workers are pretty upset right now. There was a, during the last contract negotiations in 2015, the steel industry was kind of in a dark time. There were record levels of imports. It was, there were layoffs like left and right. East Chicago 10 got idled for a while. It was just dark. So the steel workers had agreed, you know, they're going to, they're going to accept frozen pay. They were going to make all these concessions to help make the steel companies like survive and profitable again. And they've led the charge on getting tariffs to, you know, protect the steel industry, which has been an ongoing process. And they have, they proposed, like, with the ArcelorMittal's case, consolidating all the healthcare plans. They ended up saving the company a bunch of money that way. And then they assumed it's a very cyclical industry, so the assumption was they're making sacrifices then in the dark time, and when times got good, then they would share in the benefits and share in the rewards. Especially with Section 232 tariffs, steel prices are over like $900 a ton. The industry is like very profitable. ArcelorMittal just turned a $1.8 billion profit in the second quarter. U.S. Steel turned around $200 million, I think. And, everybody's doing pretty well in the U.S. steel industry right now for the first time in years. And however, when they went to the negotiating table, the steelworkers assumed, you know, they'd go in with more leverage and so on. But the companies came out demanding concessions. They want to shift a lot of the healthcare costs to workers. In the case of ArcelorMittal, I think it's as much as like $8,000 in additional out-of-pocket costs that they, you know, steelworkers would have to pay. They're saying even with some of the tepid pay increases the companies are proposing, some workers would end up losing money in terms of total compensation. And they're just very upset with all the concessions that the steelworkers are asking for, and the steelworkers are saying on their side that they need to be competitive. They need to be competitive with mini mills. That's an international market for steel. They need to kind of keep, you know, their labor costs within line, and they're facing all kinds of pressures, both domestically from mini mills and internationally from all these importers of steel like China and Turkey and so on. And, they got to watch their costs to stay in business. But the steelworkers went on strike voted, U.S. Steel employees voted nationally overwhelmingly to authorize a strike if they can't reach some kind of agreement with U.S. Steel, and ArcelorMittal steelworkers will be going on Monday to the union halls for the strike vote. Locally in Gary, East Chicago, and Portage, it was unanimous, I think, in pretty much every case where U.S. steelworkers had voted. They were particularly upset that U.S. Steel had proposed getting rid of traditional pay increases in the last 3 years of a six-year contract and switching mainly toward profit-sharing bonuses, which may or may not materialize, and which local steelworkers have been promised before and never actually gotten. So they were very reluctant about that, and then the healthcare, they're just looking to preserve the healthcare that they've won through, you know, years and years of collective bargaining, and not have all the shifts to local families. It doesn't guarantee a work stoppage. It just, they went back to Pittsburgh. The USW went back to Pittsburgh yesterday, mm-hmm. and they resumed negotiations. U.S. Steel came out with an immediate new contract proposal. They're saying it includes like $19,000 in bonuses, a 4% raise upfront, 2% raises for the next 5 years. U.S. Steel has a lot of, USW has a lot of concerns with it. It would double health care costs. They're saying the bonus is kind of a sleight of hand because it's part of it is profit sharing that they've already earned. And then part of it is kind of what they describe as a bribe to get them to go to high deductible health care plans that would ultimately, U.S. Steel is proposing $1,500 a year to cover like, you know, the higher deductible costs that steelworkers would face. But they're saying, you know, this will end up costing workers a lot more in the long run.
Is there also a concern, too, for those folks who happen to be on the lower end of the pay scale, that any changes might affect them, that they might be, of course, hoping that with a better contract, they might be getting a pay raise if they feel that they need one, but that may be out of the running there?
Yes. U.S. Steel is definitely offering pay raises at this point. But the and so is Arcelor. But the question is how much workers have gone. You know, cost of living has continued to go up.
Yeah.
They're decent paying jobs, but they're not. You know, but cost of living has continued to go up, and all the workers have gone at least 3 years without any increase to pay. But they've had higher expenses for virtually everything since then.
Yeah.
And one thing they're particularly upset about is that while the workers made sacrifices, a lot of the executives had paid themselves bonuses during the downturn, particularly. At U.S. Steel for some of their cost-cutting initiatives, they took home millions of dollars in incentive bonuses, and the concern is that the management didn't share in the sacrifices of the workforce, and that they got paid, and now it's time for everyone to kind of share in the now that the company is profitable again.
Let me ask Joe here. Now I know that there is I don't want to call it a cooling off period, but we'll say that if things don't do well in the continuing negotiations, and it does come down to that there is likely to be a strike, it won't be happening right away. In other words, the gates won't get locked right away. That there's going to be some delay, but then I wonder what's going to happen in that time period between the time that the official word comes out that the USW is going on strike at U.S. Steel and the time that the plant actually starts to kind of slow down in operation because there are people on strike.
Yes, they can't just walk off the job because the blast furnaces have to run around the clock. It takes time to safely, shut everything down.
Yeah.
The steelworkers, I would say they probably do have a lot of leverage right now because the steel prices are so high domestically that if, the companies would be losing out on a lot of potential revenue and profits if they were to experience any kind of work stoppage at this point. From what I've heard from steel analysts, normally in the past they've stockpiled steel to prepare for this kind of contingency. But apparently they might have been a little bit surprised by that it would kind of come this far, that they haven't really been stockpiling the way they historically have, so they're not sitting on these inventories that they could then continue to sell to customers. Both U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal say they've been trying to work toward a satisfactory conclusion, but the union has not been happy with this, particularly with the concessions on the health care cuts, because it's just something that they've, it's a very physically demanding job. It's a very, there are a lot of hazards and risks, and one thing that's important is good health care, because a lot of, people, steelworkers have told me, they give their back for the company, they can get, seriously injured and require medical care for the rest of their life. It's one of the more dangerous jobs, left in this country, and that it's just very important to have a good health care plan in case, the worst were to happen.
Now, we know we've talked here primarily about how the United Steelworkers Union is dealing with U.S. Steel and the contracts, and I think that I'm guessing that they are the representative company where the contract is coming up. What kind of impact might we see with ArcelorMittal and some of the other mills?
With ArcelorMittal, there's going to be strike authorization votes on Monday, and mm-hmm. it's going to be at Burns Harbor, East Chicago, and mainly at Burns Harbor and East Chicago. And they are so far it kind of came to a head a little bit earlier with U.S. Steel. The union was a little bit more upset with their proposal, but they're saying they're not making much progress with Arcelor lately. Too, the contracts have both expired. There were 3-year contracts that expired through September 1st, but both sides have kind of agreed to continue the negotiations under the old contracts. This isn't entirely unheard of. Last time when they had usually it actually does kind of stretch out this long. Last time when they did have the contract negotiations in 2016, which was also kind of largely about preserving benefits, contract talks spilled over several months into 2016. It just went on, you know, into the next year. And what one of the steel analysts has characterized this as, like, you know, during the early years, the unions were fighting for all these, you know, increases in pay, increases in benefits, increases in working conditions, and so forth. And then lately, it's mainly just been a fight to kind of preserve what they already have. The companies are, you know, proposing at least modest pay increases at this point. You know, it's all going to be sorted out in negotiations. Yeah. Both sides are going to make proposals and counterproposals, and nothing is finished until there's, you know, an agreement. But the one area that seems to be the biggest is just the companies are looking to take away the current healthcare plans and switch to kind of high deductible ones, or ones where they're paying, you know, in the case, like U.S. Steel's latest one, they're asking steelworkers to pay about $145 a month. And then the union is estimating it would cost another $2,000 a year in co-pays and co-insurance and deductibles, and that they're just not wanting to shift that cost onto workers. Some workers I've talked to have said the one thing they're really afraid of now is, you know, the company's like, oh, well, it's only $150 now, but then, you know, next time there's a contract, they're going to ask the workers to pay $350, and it's just going to keep going up and up and up. And once, as soon as they, you know, as soon as they accept out-of-pocket costs, there's not going to be any end to it, because then U.S. Steel or Arcelor is just going to claim that, you know, the cost of doing business is too high, and they need to, you know, transfer this on to the workers to be competitive. And the workers are just afraid that everything that they've won over the years through collective bargaining will be eroded away.
Well, Joe, it sounds like that we know now. Of course, we have a better idea right now what's happening as far as U.S. Steel is concerned with the labor unions. And we'll look ahead here for the first of next week when we get more information from you here about ArcelorMittal and of course, more from some of the other mills and the impact it's all going to have here on Northwest Indiana. And so we'll have you back on again to talk about that, get the updates there, too. We really appreciate it. Thank you, Joe, for being with us to spend some time talking today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking with Joe Pete, who covers business news for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's turn now to take a look at some of the latest events that have happened in the city of Gary, and for that, we are turning it to Greg Tejeda. He's a reporter for the Post Tribune, who covers primarily the city of Gary, and as always, Greg, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, one of the big stories, and we can touch on, I know it's been talked about before, we had it on a previous program, was the update at the time about the very special town hall or public forum meeting or whatever you want to call it that the City of Gary administration held at the Art House in Gary to talk about the issues of city finances, in particular about the more than $8 million shortfall that's come up in the EMS fund. And you were at that meeting as well, too. We've had some look at it here in recent days, and I know that you have covered in your stories have been out there in print and online, focusing on not only the, I guess, the concern about the shortfall. I guess the investigation is one area too that I know that the city has been very careful, maybe in some less detail to talk about. Fill us in on what you got out of the meeting at the Art House first off.
Well, officially, we're talking about the fund. What's known as the 224 Fund, mm-hmm. which is the part of the city budget that is controlled by the fire department, giving the fire chief money to pay for expenses related to emergency medical services, paramedics, equipment for them. That's what the money is supposed to be used for. However, it would appear that from a period stretching from the beginning of 2015 through March of this year, some $8.1 million was transferred out of that fund and scattered around to various parts of the budget. Even though technically transfers are supposed to be approved, the council is supposed to approve each and every single one of those, sign off on them, these things just got approved, you know, they were just done. Now, city officials are trying to emphasize that these were legitimate expenses. In fact, a little over half of that money wound up being transferred over to other parts of the budget to make payroll.
Yeah.
So there are city workers who got to pay their salaries because of that. However, what came out of it is, out of the particular hearing, is the figure of $131,850.49. Of that $8.1 million, that's the amount of money that they can't account for, what, how it disappeared, which is why one member of the council is admitting the word theft may have to be considered.
Yeah.
They're not ready to call in the U.S. attorney and have anyone indicted yet, but they're that little piece they can't quite account for. And they're still trying to figure out, you know, this is probably going to go beyond having the accounting firm out of Merrillville do a review of their finances. At the very least, the State Board of Accounts is going to have an issue to look into, and we'll see where it goes from there, the investigation.
And I suppose, too, even the State Board of Accounts may insist that the state police or some other law enforcement agencies step in and take over looking further, which it could very well lead to some charges being filed. But that would be down the road anyway, wouldn't it?
Right. That has not happened as yet.
I noticed in your story, in the paper, Greg, that you mentioned about the fact that the Mayor Freeman Wilson, when she had her conversation with everybody at that public forum that I mentioned, that I guess there is a complicating factor in taking a look at all of this. What seems to be the fly in the ointment, so to speak?
Well, it seems that a lot of the people who were around who might have actually had a position in this, they've already been let go.
Uh-huh.
They're gone. As it turns out, the city controller, Zelita Green, she actually retired and left the city payroll back in February. And the deputy controller, Michelle Roby, she was dismissed from her position back in May when it became apparent that there was going to be some shortfall in the funds. So as far as having the people who might have actually known firsthand what's going on, they're already gone. So technically they're having to try to piece together, you know, after the fact, what happened. And now I'm not saying necessarily these people have something to hide or covering up, but it like you said, it complicates the process.
Mm-hmm.
Things might be a lot easier if they were still around in the position where they could just explain themselves. Well, why was all this done? Why were these transfers done? Why did you feel the need to just go ahead and move the money about without bringing the matter to the council to review each and every single transfer, which technically is what state law would require to be done.
Mm-hmm. I know that in your story that they mentioned that the mayor had even said that, you know, I think she stopped short of accusing anybody of any malfeasance, at least what they would call, you know, that would press charges on. But she says that apparently that there was quite a violation of the spirit of the law.
The spirit being that you bring each and every transfer to the council and let them review it and let them sign off on approving the money, thereby mm-hmm. making it public knowledge what's going on here. She says that it may just very well have been that officials felt the need to try to cut the process short because they felt, you know, the urgency to get the money moved about and make sure bills got paid. And in some cases, it would appear the transfers were made right before the payrolls were supposed to be met. And if they didn't act quickly, somebody might not have been getting their paycheck, and that was felt to be the bigger problem. They were more interested in trying to keep things moving rather than necessarily following every single step of the process.
Do you get the impression, at least what was mentioned publicly from the meeting that night, that Mayor Freeman Wilson is concerned about making sure that not only that the shortfall is at least accounted for, so they know exactly what happened to that missing $180-some thousand, but it may also kind of press things along and what she and other administration officials want to do to try to make up some of the money by this idea of selling and then leasing back the public safety building.
I think from her perspective, what she was kept trying to emphasize, and she actually has a legitimate point. I know some people are going to try to claim she's trying to spin away from the idea that money may have been taken. She says that this is more evidence of just how flawed Gary's finances are and that they're having to rely on these last-minute transfers in order to make sure bills get paid.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, because the income flow is so unstable in parts and there are shortfalls, and they have to resort to measures such as considering selling off the public safety building, that it would be better off for them, you know, if they could stabilize the finances. And this is probably just more evidence of why they need to do something long range, because there's only so long you can keep going with these little transfers here and there to pay, make sure everybody gets paid. Because, yes, if your city workers don't get paid on time, then you're going to have some real problems.
And they've had some instances where they've come dangerously close, and we know that the problem has already happened with Gary Community School Corporation employees. And this was pre-takeover days when they were, as the school board, trying to deal with these problems on their own.
Well, it is a precarious position in Gary. I mean, taking into account this fact, last year's budget, 2017, Gary took in $110.9 million in income. That's how much money came in.
Mm-hmm.
They had $124.6 million in bills. And to make up this shortfall, they're juggling money around all over the place. Gary is not a very wealthy town. Gary, that's putting it mildly.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a situation they're going to have to deal with for the long term.
Well, I know, too, that you're going to be having stories coming out in print and online in the Post-Tribune in the future as I get time to take a look at the 2019 budget. So we'll find more interesting stories, I'm sure, to come out of City Hall from that as well, too. One of the other stories, Greg, that you happen to have recently out there involves Common Council member Reagan Hatcher. And that also involves some money there, too. Tell us about that.
Reagan Hatcher, the member of the Common Council, the daughter of Mayor Dick Hatcher, and the soon-to-be member of Indiana House of Representatives, is buying herself a new house in the Miller neighborhood. She actually already lives in the Miller neighborhood. This house is about two blocks away. It's one that had been foreclosed on and had actually been abandoned for 6 years, and the bank turned it over to the city, which then put it up for auction, and she wound up being the lone bidder. So she's buying a new house. Now, as it turns out, she put in a bid of $65,001 to buy the property, but then later found out that's probably way more than it was worth. So she managed to talk the Gary Redevelopment Commission into accepting her offer of $31,040, which apparently was a median figure based on all the different appraisals,
mm-hmm.
which stretched from $25,000 to $37,000 at the property value. And she got them to accept $31,000. So she now has a house, which she admits is in need of serious repair if it's going to be lived in. She's hoping to be moved in there by January. So, and she's also looking to place her old house up for sale because that's where she's figuring the money for the rehab is going to come from.
I was going to say that you have to come up with cash someplace to pay the contractors because she's going to have to do, if you say, a lot of extensive work to get the other place fixed up that she's gotten the bid on and then gotten the Redevelopment Commission Award for. Now, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what comes out of that, too. Although I'm sure that
she was able to hand over a check for the $31,000.
Oh, she was? $30. Okay.
Yes, she had a certified check with her that day, and she turned it over and now has the title for the property.
That's great, which is good because we know that that's one. She may have extra houses, but she's going to get rid of the one that she's in right now. So I'm sure that whenever it's ready, the other one's ready to go. So it'll be interesting to see about that. Is her current place is in Miller as well too? As like this one that she's bought?
Two blocks away. She's making a two block move, but staying within the same neighborhood. She claims it's just the new house she's moving into. It's just one she's always admired, thought had some unique character to it, and then when she found out it was up for grabs, she went for it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that maybe this place too might have been one that in her youth that she might have seen in when Gary was in better days?
It's always possible.
That's interesting.
You know, I can't say that for sure, but it's always possible. I mean, she is lifelong Gary resident.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other stories, too, I know, Greg, that you covered, and we've talked in other terms about in other stories and other conversation, is I guess what could best be described as the ruins of the former City Methodist Church in downtown Gary. And there's an interesting story that you put out there as well to talk about that. Bring us up to date, please.
Yes, the Gary Redevelopment Commission has worked out terms for a $46,000 loan. The Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority is going to provide them money. They're going to do a study of the structure to determine if there's any materials in there that would pose a risk to the public health. They've already done a study of the structure for asbestos. Now they're looking for any other materials. I mean, we're talking a building that was erected back in 1926,
mm-hmm.
and building standards, there's always a possibility, I'm told, with older structures, that something may have been used there that wouldn't have been used in modern construction that they'd want to be aware of. So they're hoping to do this study. They're hoping that they find that all these people who've broken in there over the years haven't exposed themselves to anything hazardous. But they want to find out for sure what exactly all that rubble consists of.
And I know that there's one fellow who has done a rather extensive review of the facility. He's gone in, like I said, probably without permission, I'm sure, at times. But he's put out a blog site on the internet that talks about the ruins of the church, had pictures and all, and shows it's in pretty sad shape, to be sure. And I know that you know about that as well, too.
Some of the graffiti in there, some of the rubble, it's kind of depressing. You know, I've been in there myself a couple times, most recently when Gary did their tour of the downtown area and allowed people into some of the old structures.
Yeah.
They opened up the gates and I was able to walk in there and start taking a few pictures of my own. You know, some of it is just pretty sad the way that thing is deteriorated.
Yeah. I understand there are areas that, although you wouldn't figure there'd be water unless it happens to be a very high water table, but there's actually flooded areas in that old church.
Well, there's also parts of the roof that are totally missing. You know,
yeah.
You look up and see the sky. You know, when it rains in there, it gets drenched.
I would imagine so. Well, it will be very, very attractive, I guess, if they are able to do what they would like to do. And I know that the city of Gary has had assistance from the James L. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation to be able to go in there and do what they want to do. They've received money in one of the foundation's grants that is going to help do the ruins, urban ruins garden, I think is what they're calling it. So
right.
It'll be interesting what they can actually turn it into. But yeah, they've had a lot of work to do before they even get to that point, I would imagine.
Well, they openly talked this is going to take several years to get all the way through to the point where it becomes an attraction. I mean, like I said, this building was opened as a church in 1926. It may be around 2026 when it'll be fully ready. I mean, maybe you'll celebrate its centennial by turning it into a tourist attraction.
Greg Tejeda is a reporter, covers the city of Gary for the Post Tribune. As always, Greg, thank you for spending time with us to talk here on Regionally Speaking about the stories.
Thank you.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte, and our thanks to the reporters who joined us on Reporters Roundtable Thursday today. We had Mark Chase with the Times of Northwest Indiana, as well as Joseph Pete from the Times and Greg Tejeda from the Post Tribune. And we thank them for being with us on the program, and we thank you for joining us as well, too. We'll be back with you on Monday.